Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Need expert advice on your family's health? Speak to us today at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
First guest today has just published a new novel, Earth, and it is the second in his Element series. So there's water has been out already. This is Earth. There is fire and air. The back cover of Earth says you can't bury who you are. John Boyne, good morning.
Good morning, Brendan.
That's a very definitive statement on your book cover. I like to feel you can try and bury who you are, certainly. it's very bleak to think you can't bury who you are. You can't hide it. But anyway, we spoke back in October when the first book, Water, came out. And just to explain to people again, Element's four linked standalone novellas coming out at kind of 6 month intervals.
They come out every 6 months. They are standalone. Alone, but a minor character from each becomes the narrator of the next one, and they share themes in common and some characters in common.
Okay, so tell us a bit about Earth first then.
Well, if readers have read Water, they'll remember a teenage boy called Evan, who is in one chapter of that book and goes missing and is found. But he picks up the story in Earth. He's a young guy who goes to England. He hopes to be an artist. He doesn't have the talent. What he does have the talent for is he's a really, really good footballer, although he's not really interested in football. He doesn't want to be a footballer. He wants to be an artist, but he ends up as a footballer. And when the novella starts, we open on the morning of a trial where he and another teammate are being brought to court and tried for rape and accessory to rape.
Okay, now look, there are loads of threads in this book that we could pull at, right? There is one that's quite devastating, and I suppose it's something I hadn't thought a lot about before, right? So the main character, Evan, is gay. He falls in love with like more than one straight boys or men, and it is hugely damaging to him as well. Is that more common than we might think? Is that something you've experienced in life, yeah?
Yeah, I guess it is. It is common. You don't fall in love with somebody's sexuality, I suppose. You fall in love with, you know, the person that you know, the person that you meet. And I guess that is something that has happened to me in life at times. And
has it? Yeah.
Yeah. Usually with you know, okay consequences. You know, where you if you talk it out, you get over it. But you know, there's been a couple of occasions, perhaps, where not so much.
Okay, and so are you aware you're in these circumstances? Are you aware you're falling in love with a straight guy and that there's no hope? Kind of.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Right.
I mean, I remember the first time I fell in love. I guess I was about 22, and it was when I was in Norwich in UEA, and it was literally the first guy that I really had any feelings for, and we became like really close friends. You know, we were going out together every night and going drinking, and we were both aspiring writers on the writing course. And I was overwhelmed by those feelings and I'd never experienced them before. So it was a learning curve for me.
Did you know he wasn't having the same kind of feeling?
Oh, yeah.
You know, sometimes you feel if there's something there that both of us must be feeling
well,
this like.
Yeah, I guess I was so young and, you know, relatively innocent in those days that it was hard to know. There was a very quick friendship, very like bonded very quickly. So I suppose I did think, you know, well, you never know. maybe there's a chance.
But yeah, and is it kind of devastating then?
It can be sometimes. In that case, it was, because when I did explain my feelings for him, bear in mind this was 1994, so people were a lot less open to such things perhaps then than now. But when I explained my feelings to him that time, it was a pretty devastating afternoon. I remember he did not take it well, shall we say?
Really? Yeah.
Yeah, he was quite aggressive about it, and it kind of put a pall, I suppose, over my year a little bit then. But that was quite difficult to deal with, because I thought, you know, we're both 22 years old. I mean, you know, I did think kind of, well, get over it. I can get over it. You can get over it. You know, it's not like I did anything. But then, you know, there's been one or two others who've been very, very kind, where I talked to them and said, you know, like, I developed feelings for you or whatever. And they've been like, well, you know, it's not going to happen, but like, we're friends. And some people have been very kind at the same time. But it's not a constant thing or anything. Any more than it would be constant for a straight person to be falling in love with another straight person. You
know, I know. But still, it's an interesting one, because I do think there can be interesting dynamics between straight guys and gay guys sometimes, right? For example, like, do you think the straight guys are always like naively, you know, blissfully unaware of this, or is can there be a part in straight guys that like the attention that
oh, some of them milk it.
Really, yeah.
Oh, God, yeah, some of them milk it. Not when I was growing up, I would say, but now I think a little bit more. They would, because, you know, people are so much more fluid on these kind of issues, and I think people quite like the attention.
Yeah. So they play along a bit, like...
Yeah, and enjoy. And then you know you can kind of like flirt a little bit maybe with somebody, and it's fun.
Yeah.
You know, I'm 52 years old now. I wouldn't really bother doing that with any serious intent, with a straight person. But, you know, when you're 20s, you know, maybe more. But I don't think I'd bother now. But you know, there are people that I know who are straight who I definitely have more flirtatious relationships with, shall we say, than others.
And that's a bit of harmless fun.
Oh, God, yeah. It's just a laugh.
Come here. And we leave this topic then, but there is one other thing that struck me in it. So Evan, the reason he has left the island party, he kissed his childhood friend Cormac, right?
Yeah.
And Cormac is extremely cruel to him afterwards.
Yes.
And it kind of like ruins Evan's life. And I was thinking, possibly again, not so much now, but there must have been an Ireland where if you're young and you're gay and you're thinking, what are the vibes here? Who do I try and kiss? All that kind of thing, that it was kind of fraught with the potential danger for that kind of thing.
Yeah, certainly when I was growing up, it certainly would have been, you know, in school or even in college, it would have been quite difficult because you did not know what the response of somebody would be. And it doesn't have to be always a violent response. You know, in this case, you know, it's words can really, really hurt. You know, we all know that, you know, whether it's in any form of life, somebody can say something to you that actually does leave you with a certain amount of trauma. And, you know, we do live in a time where people say be kind, and we should be kind because words can inflict just as much as a punch, I think, sometimes perhaps more.
Yeah. But then again, like I'm thinking back to, you know, when we were young in Ireland, in the 80s, whatever, I'd say a lot of straight guys weren't equipped either to know how to deal with that kind of thing.
Yeah, and then they would have been, if they felt that you thought they were gay or something, that would be, you know, that would not go down very well. Like, it certainly wouldn't have been, like, in school days, it's not something I would have ever
tried. So would that would have been the reaction, is you think I'm gay, oh my God, and then possibly, oh God, am I gay? Am I sending off gay vibes? Yeah, it's fascinating stuff, isn't it? Now, the other thing fascinating, Earth is set, as you were saying, in the milieu of... professional football.
Yeah.
What was interesting about that milieu for you?
Well, you know, I've never really been a big football guy, although I've got more into it for some reason in the last sort of 10 years. But I've always been interested in these professions as such that are very male bondy, you know, and that seem to bring a sort of toxic masculinity in some way. And I'm not going to generalize here, because I'm not going to say that all football players are, you know, toxic in some way. Of course, they're not. But what interested me a lot was the fact of boys who are brought into academies very young. I have a friend who, for many years, has been coaching kids in these, you know, weekend leagues in London. And they train a couple of times a week and they play on Saturdays and Sunday mornings. And he's been doing that for like 20-odd years. And he told me, you know, a few years back that they always have these talent scouts from major clubs who come to watch these kids. And some of these kids will get, you know, spotted, and their parents will be approached, and they'll be brought to academies to see, you know, are you any good? You know, can we potentially train you? And I was always kind of interested in that when you become very, very young, you're brought in with a talent in something to an environment where everything is kind of done for you. And I remember watching a 6-part documentary by Crystal Palace, where they showed all these kids from about 6 up till 16, and what they go through, and the fact that they see that everybody around them is the competition. You know, if you're a 7-year-old kid and you're playing football with your 7-year-old mates, you know, you think you're just friends, but actually you're very quickly trained, these are not your friends. Every 6 months, we're going to let some of you go. Every 6 months, we're going to let some of you go forward. And of course, in time, they see, you know, this is maybe a way of life that I could, you know, I could make a lot of money. You know, they're in the academies are right where the clubs are often. They go through the parking lots and see the players' cars. They're into football all the time. And they get obsessed with it, I think. And they feel that there is only one world. And going through that with other guys and then going through puberty effectively with all these boys as well, and being in this environment where there is nobody of the other sex there, I think at times it can produce an unhealthy view on masculinity, an unhealthy view on women in the world and the role of women and what women are, what women's rights are in that sense. And again, I don't want to generalize. This is not appropriate to everybody, but it can.
So it's like a kind of a really, really extreme version of an all-boys school, essentially. But then I suppose added into it is this sense of privilege, use that word, like Evan.
Yeah, privilege, competition.
Evan never washes his underpants because there's just new pairs there all the time.
Yeah, and they, you know, and of course, some of the things, you know, when you look down the line to retirement as footballers, I often thought about writing about a footballer, you know, in their mid 30s who finishes. You know, not everybody can go on to be Gary Lineker or David Beckham or something, you know, post football career. Most of us are getting our careers off the ground when we're in our mid 30s. I know I was, you know, I got mine off the ground really around 34, 35 with striped pajamas. But for footballers, that's when it's all coming to an end. And you're just an asset really to these clubs. And when it's over, when you're out, suddenly you go into a world where half the time you don't know how to boil an egg. You know, and you like everything has been done for you, as you say, your entire life since childhood in the academies. So I wanted to explore that and just think what the effect would have, that would have. There'd be some positive effects, but there would have to be some negative effects on your psyche when you just don't really know anything about the outside world. And that's what I thought about with Evan. And then there was also the aspect, the thing I wanted to write about it for a while was the fact that, you know, online you often find these, I don't sound like I go searching for them, but we all hear about them, videos of footballers who have these kind of, hope this is okay to say this early on a Saturday morning, but orgies with, they always have the other footballers present, and there might be just one girl. And it seems to me sometimes they need the validation of the audience, just like they need the validation on a Saturday afternoon when they're playing on the pitch. They need somebody.
And again, these are rare cases.
Of course, they're rare, but they happen. Yeah. And we've all been exposed to the multiple court cases in recent years in various team sports, some of which have led to convictions, some of which have led to acquittals.
But acquittals because people were found innocent.
Because we have a jury system and a jury finds somebody innocent, and so be it. If we accept the guilty verdicts, we have to accept the innocent verdicts as well. But still, oftentimes at these trials, we do hear of events that have taken place that perhaps if defendants admit to that are troubling.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And in a way, it feels like the opposite of intimacy, which is what you imagine a healthy sexuality is.
Yes.
And that it's more some kind of group situation where it's about the lads together and something.
Yeah. Can I just say as well, because, you know, football historically has been such a homophobic environment that it's always seems sort of strange to me that that's the case. You know, that guys would be doing all this when there is that. You know, I think there's 534 players in the Premier League on contract. If there's 534, that means 53.4 of them are gay. And there isn't a single one who's out.
None right now.
No, not in the Premier League.
Okay. There's another little thread in there is that, like, so Evan, as you said, reluctant footballer, he has this pushy father then, and you did find that can be a thing in football as well, that it's often the fathers pushing them.
I remember, not always the fathers as well, sometimes the mothers, but I remember my friend telling me as well, if he could ban all parents from the touchline, he would. He said, because they're the worst. You know, they're the worst. And again, in some of the documentaries I watched and some of the people in the academies I spoke to, there is this sense that some of those parents are seeing that this child has some extraordinary talent and we could make a lot of money out of this. On the other hand of that, there is also the fact that for a lot of them, this is a way out of poverty for our child. So sometimes it's done with the best intent. You know, there are kids that are growing up in any country in quite poor conditions. And this is the way out of it. I read recently that I think Mo Salah, you know, from Liverpool, you know, he gives something like 400 scholarships to people from his hometown because he grew up in poverty. So there is that aspect as well. But you do see on the documentaries that I watched and in talking with coaches in the research that sometimes those parents can be quite unkind to their children. They can be the ones screaming at them in the parking lot, you know, you missed that free kick or you missed this, that or the other. And we do have to remember these are children And children have to be allowed to evolve as children and not just as an asset.
Yeah. And it's funny, it leaves Evan, I think, with some daddy issues, that whole dynamic he has with his father. We read a lot about the usual books in Ireland. It's about men and their mother issues.
Yeah.
But you're exploring the daddy issues.
Yeah, the mother
is
quite kind in this one.
Yeah. Your own dad, I believe, is a special day for him today.
It is. Yeah. It is. He turned 90 earlier this week. So we're having his 90th birthday party this evening. And I have to say, a kinder, more loving, more supportive father a man could not have.
Really? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, he and my mum have always, right from the start when I wanted to be a writer, have just been the two people more than anyone else who has had my back and, you know, paid a few bills for me when I needed them back in
really,
the day.
Really? Isn't that fantastic? Because I'd say a lot of people, if they turn around and said to their parents, I'm going to be a writer, they go, OK, so A, you're going to sell out the family and all our secrets, and B, you're never going to make a living. So
What I always say about my parents on this is that they saw that I was actually doing it. You know, as a teenager, I was sitting in my room writing. I was sending out stories. You know, I was getting a couple of stories published on occasion. So at least I wasn't just sitting there saying, I want to do something. I was actively doing it. And I think because of that, they thought, well, you know, let's give him a shot here.
What did your dad do himself?
An insurance broker.
Okay, so a million miles away from all of that, but still he got it. That's
but
nice,
like me,
it?
He effectively, you know, he was his own boss. He ran his own business. And I guess I'm my own boss as well. So, you know, I saw
that. So an entrepreneurial strain.
Yeah.
You've talked about the way you kind of learned about the football world and all that kind of thing. And like, Evan is a professional footballer, but he's also an outsider in sports-wise and all that. And I suspect, were you as well in turn, you were a big rugby school and everything, apart from the other complications of your time there. Is that something that's still there for you, that you being a non-sporty
terrible.
Guy in a sporty environment?
Yeah. You know, I live opposite Marley Park and I go for a walk there almost every day. And my biggest dread, my biggest fear in life is, because there's always kids playing football, is the ball coming my way. And, you know, and somebody shouting, kick it back.
Yeah.
You know, because I just know I'll just, it will be a total embarrassment. Something horrible will happen.
Yes.
So yeah, I was pretty terrible at it. And you know, in the early days, because even in junior school in De La Salle, you know, we had to play rugby. We were forced to, I think around second, third year or something, you were allowed, you know, run for the hills. But I dreaded it. And you know, the sight of, you know, all these guys running at me and ready to pound me into the ground, it wasn't great. I mean, I guess I was a bit, you know, some of that standard kind of nerdy, bookish guy that did not feel comfortable on a wet, cold pitch on a Saturday morning, you know, with a ball ready to, you know, knock him out if he doesn't catch it.
Yeah, I think, you either have that gene or you don't. I didn't have it either. But you kind of found fitness and all that.
Yeah,
like,
that
later on.
And, you know, I have, like, I got more into football in recent years. For the first time in my life this year, I've only put one bet on in my entire life.
Really?
I put a bet on at the start of the Premier League season this year, just to give me a little bit more interest in it. I put €100 on Arsenal at 5-1. And, you know, we're in the closing weeks. I don't know how much you know about football, but they're close. But
I'm
maybe not close enough.
Yeah, okay, so. Okay. Evan says at one point, John, I think sometimes there are people who are destined never to have anyone fall in love with them. There's something indefinable about them that makes people turn away. And I was cast back to a conversation we had before, I think, the first time I spoke to you on the show. And I think that was the space you were probably in at that time. Is that, did that come from you?
Yeah. I mean, I think there were certainly times that I felt that. I'm sure there's times that many of your listeners have felt that. And that can be a distressing thing at times, especially if you feel that, like, I don't think everybody needs to be in a couple, I have to say. I think sometimes people work perfectly well on their own and need their own independence and are good with their own solitude.
Yeah.
But some people feel like, I think, more that they need it. You know, I've been in and out of relationships through my life in the last few years as well, and some good, some bad. And, you know, I've come out of them and I feel like in a really great space at the moment. I think I'm sort of as happy as I've ever been, mostly because I've made my peace with all of that. I feel fitter and healthier. I think I'm writing at the best I've ever written, and writing, you know, these four books are a real challenge, and trying some other things, script writing and so on. So I don't think I need a partner necessarily to survive, but when I'm in a relationship, I'm enjoying it, you know, and giving it my,
yeah,
my best.
Yeah, you're able to do it. Because yeah, there was a time, I think, you felt, actually, I'm not able to do this. I'm not able to be in love, or I'm not able to be loved.
Yeah, 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 I did. I don't feel that now at all. Yeah. Like, I think, I guess my self-esteem is completely different. There was a time, certainly about 7 years ago, 8 years ago, where I felt, you know, I'm just not worthy of
yeah,
that. I don't feel that at all. I feel like I certainly am.
Great. You know? Yeah, yeah.
I think everybody
was there something that clicked for you?
I don't know, maybe turning 50 or something. And, you know, maybe in the last couple of years, you know, I've had some really good relationships with people that I've come out of the relationship feeling, you know, I've made friends with them.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
there's been no downsides, there's been no recriminations. There's been, you get through a natural end of something and you say, well, you know, there we are. It's not working on a romantic level, but no one's done anything bad to each other. So, you know, there's that. And maybe just turning 50 and all these sort of challenges and the writing going so well. And look, losing a lot of weight and feeling fitter and healthier and better about myself. It's just put me in a really, really good space, I think, in life.
That's brilliant. Yeah, yeah. I think there's a lot of men are kind of thriving more as they get older these days. You mentioned screenwriting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've been giving that a shot, and I sold actually a script to Hat Trick Productions just before Christmas.
All right. Yeah.
You know, Jimmy Mulville runs them. They did Derry Girls and all that. So I was just in London with them the other day. And so I've got an idea for a 10-part series, an original one, and sold them the idea and a couple of episodes. So I'm doing some redrafts on that and then going to go out to all the obvious places, you know, the Netflixes and so on. And who knows if anything will get, if it'll get made, but it's been a challenge because I never wrote scripts before. You know, I tried in my mid-30s. I tried to write a script, an adaptation of my third novel, Crippen.
Yeah.
And I gave it to my film agent. And the first thing he said when he read it was, have you ever actually seen a film? So I decided to take a break from that then and just concentrated on the novels. But then again, during the pandemic, I wanted a new challenge, and I started, and a friend of mine who's an actress decided or said to me, you know, I'd like to, would you write something for me? And so I did, and we couldn't get it sold, but I found it very interesting doing that. And
then whole different set of rules and everything,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it is. And like, you know, obviously I'm so used to the prose and suddenly writing dialogue. But, you know, a lot of people have pointed out to me that I write a lot of dialogue in my books anyway. And
yeah,
some of my most popular books, like Hearts of Invisible Furies, are very dialogue-based.
Yeah.
I've actually really, really enjoyed it. It's been a lot of fun to do. And with each one, I think I'm getting a little bit better. And then I was commissioned to adapt another Irish writer's novel, Sarah Crossan, her novel Moonrise, for a feature film, which I've done, and that's out with various places. Actually, I think it's easy. I think it's better to adapt a different writer's novel than your own.
Really, yeah?
Yeah, I think it's better. You can come out with a fresh eye.
Yeah, yeah,
I almost
yeah,
would
a bit more ruthless.
Yeah, 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 and see things in a different way. I almost like to get, like, you know, two novelists and say, you do yours and I'll do mine.
Yeah, yeah,
no,
yeah,
I'll do yours and you do mine. I think that's somehow a better way. But I'm enjoying that. That's might go nowhere, who knows, but, like, you know, nothing ventured.
Yeah. See, yeah, you'd sometimes wonder, like, is it the dominant art form of the age anyway, television, film and everything like that?
I think now television
yeah,
is, certainly yeah, with everything. You know, I'm just watching, when I go home today, I'm going to watch the last episode of Ripley. I don't know if you've been watching that.
I have.
The Talented Mr. Ripley is just one of my favourite books of all time, one of my favourite movies of all time.
Me too, me too.
And I think this TV show has been extraordinary.
No, challenging at the beginning if you were a lover of The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Well, yeah,
but
I mean,
actually,
Stephen's Alien
once you get over that.
It's, in a totally different way. Yeah. And Andrew Scott in a different way than Matt Damon. I think Andrew Scott gives a brilliant performance in it. And the beauty of the cinematography. It's just wonderful. So I'm looking forward to seeing the last episode later.
Yeah. By the way, the four elements, we didn't really talk too much about the fact that the thread there a lot is around abuse and complicity,
yes,
and all that. But does it re-traumatise you as a survivor of sexual abuse to keep going back now? You're going to go back four times in these books to keep going back to that?
No. If anything, it's a catharsis.
Is it?
And yeah, it is. Because, so yeah, the first one was enabling. The second one is complicity, earth. Fire is going to be from the point of view of a perpetrator, which was a very difficult book to write. Of all the books I've written in my life, the hardest. And
to a perpetrator that you have to understand
voice,
or
yes,
have some empathy
and
for
it's a woman,
in a way, yeah?
It's okay, a woman who's doing the committing the abuse. And then the last one, Air, was written from the point of view of a victim. But actually, for me, writing about it and being able to talk about it, whether it's here on a show like yours, whether it's a newspaper article, whether it's in the book itself, I find that very cathartic. I think last time we were here, you know, I was talking about the fact that some of the other, so many of the other victims in all over the world, in various places, don't have that opportunity that I have. You know, I can write books and I have a platform to talk about it. So actually, I find it a very cathartic thing to do. And I've been able to work through both in History of Loneliness, which I wrote, I know, 12 years ago, and in these four books. And to be able to try to understand it from different perspectives. Why would somebody enable it? Why would somebody be complicit? Why would somebody do it? Yeah. How does somebody survive it? You know, it's
does
it's,
it set you free in some way, yeah?
Yeah, yeah, it does. And like, I can sit here and talk to you about it without feeling any sense of shame, which is not what I would have felt in my late teens or in my 20s. I would have felt, as it's not unnatural to sort of feel grubby in some way or feel ashamed of something that you have no reason to feel shame for. Mm. I don't feel that way in any way, shape or form now. And I'm perfectly happy to talk about it and write about it. And hopefully some people who read these books, you know, might find something in it that will help them.
Mm. As well as the, so you've the third novella, there's a children's book in July.
Yeah, my first picture book.
Yeah.
I've never, and it rhymes. It starts, there once was a boy called Jeremy Grace who had a peculiar obsession with space.
Love it, so. Love it. So come here, you were when were you giving up writing? Was that last year?
Yeah,
you were
no, that was about two or 3 years ago, yes. I think I sat in one of these studios here in RTÉ and said I was taking two or three years off.
Yeah.
And then I told my agent and I told my publisher, I cleared it with them in advance. I said to my agent and publisher, I'm going to take a couple of years off. You know, I've been through a lot, written a lot. And then I think I woke up the next morning and said, well, what do I do with my day? And I couldn't really think of anything.
Yeah, yeah.
So I started writing.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know.
Jerry Seinfeld has the thing about the guy who dreams of retiring and sitting on a beach with a beer, you know.
Yeah.
And then you get there and you sit in the beach with the beer and then you go, okay, I've done that now. Like, yeah. 30
some
years.
Some people do, like Philip Roth, he did retire. The late Philip Roth, and he was at the end, like he was getting them out one a year, and then he just said, right, that's it, I'm done.
Yeah.
And he lived for another 6 or 7 years and he never did write again. I always find that extraordinary.
He probably got out at the right time, didn't he? The culture turned on poor
Philip Roth today.
I was reading in Salman Rushdie's new book that he had a post-it note on his computer saying the struggle has ended, I think, just in case Roth did, in case he was tempted to go back and try and write something, the post-it note was there saying, no, your struggle is over, relax. Okay, John, Earth is another terrific read, and it's out now, published by...
Doubleday.
Okay, John Boyne, great to talk to you again. Thank you so much.
Thank
we'll
you.
Take a break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTÉ Radio 1.